This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
The translation of Vipassana, or mindfulness, I've read, is clear seeing, seeing through. And this is so fundamental to the Buddhist path, what the Buddha calls purifying our view. That suffering at its root is a kind of lack of seeing, or a deluded seeing. And what we're doing with mindfulness practice, with the Dharma, is slowly purifying this view so we can see more clearly. And this is quite a task, because we've always taken our perspective for granted. That how we've seen things, the ground from which we see, the assumptions that shape how we see, has gone unquestioned. And mindfulness can work never looking in this way at that ground. It can work as a stress reduction strategy. And as that, it's beautiful. But eventually the attention needs to be directed to the lens through which we see the world. Because if we don't look, we basically see the world in very deeply conditioned, habitual ways. And we see the world through the lens of the defilements. That word refers to a lot, but we could sort of broadly characterize it as craving, aversion, and unconsciousness, or sometimes translated greed, hatred, delusion. That we've actually seen we've been viewing our world through this lens. And so we see things we want, and happiness is to get them. We see things we don't want, happiness is to rid ourselves of them. And this purifying of the view requires that we attend more deeply. So this is Proust who says, the real voyage of discovery consists in not seeking new landscapes, but in seeing with new eyes. Now, I don't know what's true. I don't have I wouldn't say that. I know what's true. I know what the Dharma is. But I am good at sniffing out delusion.
Huh.
a lot of what teaching is, what talking about this practice is sensing the ways that the defilements are shaping the view. The way that greed, hatred, delusion shapes the view. Because if it shapes the view, we can't really get much happier. You know, so, and I'm not trying to be harsh about it, but if you walk around, you just take a walk in the streets, and you overhear conversations, and they're just locked within the perspective of greed, hatred, and delusion. It's totally unquestioned. And so people look for the solution within that perspective, but it can't resolve itself unless we bring our attention to how we're seeing. And the Buddha says that when we see, if we want to free the heart, we should be looking for impermanence, selflessness, and the dissatisfaction of things. Now, this is a very radical perspective, because the default mode of how we work with our life, how we see our experience, is to see permanence, to be seeking and trusting that we'll find a lasting happiness with things, by arranging our life in a certain way. And we take everything deeply personally. We take ourselves personally, and we infer self to everything. Self meaning that there's an inherent core to all things and ourself. Now, the reasons why we see permanence, self, and satisfaction, where the Buddha says we should see impermanence, not self, and dissatisfaction, is that we're not looking deeply enough. That if we look just on the surface, we don't see it, impermanence, not self, dissatisfaction. We see things as permanent. We see things as me and you. And we have a deep hope that if we could just tinker in the right way with our life, we would rid ourselves of dissatisfaction. And the Buddha asks for us to look more deeply. And so you know how like a film is, 24 frames per second? Right? And so if you look more closely at film, the movement of characters turns into stillness of the frame, right? If we look more deeply at our lives, it's just the opposite. what seemed so solid and substantial, we see as very much in flow. So, we're asked to bring our attention to these characteristics. And this is going to require that we not, that we have some direct contact, not the contact through our conceptual thought about things. Because the nature of thought, at least when we don't know it as thought, the very nature of thought is a realm of permanence and fantasy of self. Right? I don't know if you can sense this, but in the fantasies, when we drift off from the breath and we're living within the realm of thought, there really is no belief in impermanence. We're really living in this realm where we think things are permanent, where we think we know exactly who and what we are. And in that fantasy, we think we can, if we can just figure it out, right? If we could just figure out our life, if we could just think in the right way, we could find what we've been longing for. And so we're going to have to break through ordinary thinking as our contact with the world. So I'll start talking a bit about the perception of permanence and impermanence. And this can be discussed as at the kind of the way if some teachers call the macro level, like this building, this body, this sangha cannot last. That everything born comes to die. And then there's the smaller scale, the micro level, which is seeing that everything is in flux at all the time. This is Bhikkhu Bodhi, says, impermanence does not merely mean that everything eventually comes to an end. At this level, it means something deeper and more pervasive, namely, that conditioned phenomena are in constant process, happenings which break up and perish almost as soon as they arise. The stable objects appearing to the senses reveal themselves to be strings of momentary formations. So these are two ways of talking about impermanence. And the first way, the broad level of things, is a major theme in Buddhism, to see the inevitability of change and loss and death. That this was originally what alerted the Buddha to the need for a spiritual practice, that we do age, we do become ill, we do die. And sometimes I feel like my practice, like the reason why I do Buddhist practice, is to prepare for my death. To prepare for my death and prepare for the death of those who I love. And if Buddhist practice only did that for me, that would be enough. That would be enough. And so raising this issue of mortality is, you know, can feel depressing or morbid. But we raise the issue because we need to see how the denial of change, of impermanence, of death carries a kind of burden on the heart. That there's actually a burden in denying it. And the denial runs really deeply. I did the year to live practice about 4 years ago. And the year to live is a book by Stephen Levine. You actually go through month by month planning as if you were going to die at the end of the year. And it's done as a group, typically, with guidance. And there's a very, very direct conscious looking at what it is to die. And, you know, we would write eulogies for ourselves. And it was deeply moving. And one of the lessons from it was that the level of denial about my own death is so deep that it's multi-layered. It's like you can ask somebody, do you think you're going to die? And anybody on the street would say yes, right? But we're not living from that insight. We're really not. And I would see the kind of layer after layer just peel away. Like, oh, I thought I actually believed. I thought I believed I would die. And then I saw how clearly I was living from the fantasy of immortality. This is Freud. So our own death is indeed quite unimaginable. And whenever we make the attempt to imagine it, we really survive as spectators. At bottom, nobody believes in his or her own death. Or to put the same thing in a different way, in the unconscious, every one of us is convinced of our own immortality. And so it's worth looking. Do we live from this? And what wisdom is available from considering this? What wisdom? What kind of life would we be living? What would be most important to us if the reality of our death was very clear to us? Maybe it is for some of you. Now, when I was a kid, I would try to imagine the world first without me. I was a strange kid. First without me, and then without my family, and then without people, and then no world, and then no universe. And then no time. And I would get to this breaking point where it was like a little too much emotionally. That the thought that I might never have existed, that the world, the universe might never have existed, it was like too much for my mind to handle. And our death is so foreign to us only because we live in a state of self-absorption. That very naturally our concern is with our life. But even as I was reflecting on this talk, walking, I know that there are very likely ants or insects that were killed as I walked. That meanwhile, as I consider mortality, which feels very distant to me, there are people dying and being killed. There are animals dying and being killed. And the unthinkability of my own death is a symptom of how deeply absorbed in my own sense of importance. The kind of radical self-absorption. And we don't have to punish ourselves for that, but just know that the lessons of impermanence are around us. And we deny them at our own cost. Thich Nhat Hanh said recently that civilizations are born and die. And if we are going to do something about the direction of this planet, we're going to have to grieve the end of our civilization. To see that as very real. That the trajectory of our world is towards the end of this civilization. And he asked us to consider that, to grieve the end of this civilization, because it is the only way that he envisions hope for change. To see how we've taken our world, this civilization, for granted, that we've seen permanence where there is only impermanence. And we could say that the flip side of this insight into impermanence is the insight into anatta, or not self. That the sense of an abiding witness that has been subject to my life. The little guy, the little Matthew inside that's been there all along, receiving the experiences of my life, growing up, seeing me grow up. Watching me talk right now, this sense of the witness that we grant special status to. That we put that outside of the scope of mindfulness. That's what remains unquestioned. That's the ground from which we see. That's the place of our learning. That's our teacher. But no, this becomes an object of investigation. And the witness that feels like it's been alive all along becomes another event arising and passing in the same way that sound arises and passes. We need to look deeply, to look open-heartedly. And then we start to get a little less sure of what this witness is. Start to get a little more curious about that ground. And we start to become more sensitive to the oppressiveness of taking solace in being this or that. That it's actually an oppression to think we're this or that. And it's an oppression for ourselves and makes us vulnerable in a million ways. And it's an oppression for others to need to be somebody, to maintain a particular concept of who we are. And we begin to sense that the way we've been looking has been always flavored by the sense of me-ness. And then it's not. And so we can cultivate this attention towards impermanence, selflessness, and the disappointments inherent in trying to arrange our lives perfectly. And maybe a kind of translation, maybe if I wanted to sum up these three insights, I might say that there is no such thing as a close-hearted happiness. That insofar as we will be happy, it will arise out of deep open-heartedness. It's kind of the only shot we have. If I saw other options, I would meditate less.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.